Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. All my podcast conversations are pre-recorded. It makes it more relaxed for both me and my guest. Today's talk with Taylor Crabill on U.S. employment law was recorded on January 13th. That was 1 week before the current U.S. president took office. Changes in workplaces across the U.S. have happened at lightning speed in the last 10 days. As I say 10 days and think about what I've heard of events that have unfolded in just those 10 days, my head spins. And I live in Canada. I can't even imagine what's happening in the heads of the millions of people affected by over 36 executive orders, as well as memorandum and proclamations the president has signed. Many of those are affecting more employees than I can fathom. So I'm still happy to present for you today my conversation with Taylor. He's smart, he's well-spoken. How many of the laws we discuss will stand up in U.S. courts right now, or even be eligible for a hearing, I have no idea. I do understand long-standing protections are in jeopardy, including protections from discrimination in the workplace. These protections have been part of society for decades, and employees may have assumed that they could never be taken away. However, the Trump administration stripped workplace protections for federal workers in just the first few days of his second term. The rollback of these workplace protections follows the Supreme Court's decision taking away a woman's right to choose to have an abortion from just a few years ago. Taylor does also talk about how to collect information about your discrimination or retaliation case and how to be organized for a talk with an employment lawyer. I say do that. Who knows? Maybe you or someone you know might be able to use documentation in the future. If you are listening in another allegedly democratic country, use what's happening in the U.S. right now as impetus to make sure you do your research on, do all your due diligence on, and ask a lot of specific questions of the politicians running in your next election. At the end of every conversation, I encourage you to share the episode. So important that you share this episode as far and as wide as you can. You may never know who needs this right now. My thoughts are with you all. Listen now. Discrimination. There are so many forms of it. Gender, age, skin color, wages, disability, religion, safety, harassment. What if I told you all those things could gather under one umbrella? That umbrella is your legal rights. Today's focus is the workplace. Workers' rights are both legal rights and human rights, and they are addressed in national and international labor and employment law. My guest today is an attorney specializing in employment law. He's American, so we'll speak to workplace rights as set out under American law, but if you're in a democratic country, I'm thinking, hoping, your laws are going to be similar, and this conversation today will give you the knowledge you need to make sure your rights are being respected in your workplace. And what to say or do if they aren't. Taylor Crabill, welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast.
Hey, Agnes, how are you? Thanks for having me on.
That's great. Curious, though, what, as a lawyer, as an attorney, what started you down the employment path?
Well, out of college, I got a job as a paralegal at a plaintiff-side employment law firm in New York City. I kind of had the idea of going to law school. My father's an attorney, not an employment attorney. And so it kind of always been there in the back of my head, but I wanted to get some experience before making that commitment. So I worked at a firm, had no idea about employment law. As a paralegal, I was exposed to, you know, numerous clients, different types of cases, the different laws that protect people. And was really drawn to how many protections there are in the employment laws and being able to actually to help people in a really difficult situation. And so I had that background, worked there for 2 years and went to law school, kind of tried a couple of other things, but kept coming back to employment law. And ever since then, been representing employees.
Okay. And you're licensed in two states, is that correct?
Yes, I'm licensed in Florida and New York.
Is that a process to get more than one state, or how do you go about that?
Yeah, fair enough. So each state has their own license. And so for New York and Florida, you have to take, you know, a specific test to be able to demonstrate certain competency in the law. to be admitted in those states. Some states have reciprocity, meaning if you are, like, if I'm admitted in New York, I could go through the procedures to be admitted in Connecticut, for example. And an attorney in Connecticut could do the same thing about being in New York, right? Certain states will recognize each other's licenses and say, you know, obviously if you're, you know, good enough to practice there, same goes for here. Some states don't have that. Florida was one of them, so I had to take the bar exam when I expanded my practice here.
Okay. We're going to get to employment law shortly, I promise.
No
problem. I'm just curious now, do some attorneys actually get licensed in numerous states, or is it easier just to keep your focus in one area?
It depends. I mean, maybe from a business perspective, you want to focus on certain jurisdictions. Maybe they're, you know, more favorable to the type of law that you're practicing. But it certainly, you know, could be beneficial if you're expanding your practice, if you're looking to open offices in different locations so that you can help people in those places as well. Then it would make sense to get your license in another place. You can also be, you know, maybe this is just for everyone's knowledge, you can also be admitted temporarily, right? If I had a case in Texas, I'm not admitted there, but I could get an attorney local to Texas and say, hey, can you sponsor me? And the court would say, hey, you know, you got a sponsor, you practice in these other places. Sure, come over here and we'll let you do a case or two over here.
Okay, well, I'm really glad you slipped that information in because, yeah. You know, my listenership is international. I understand you can't work outside the states, but at least if somebody's in different states, that's great. Is there any sort of discrimination that you see more of than others, you know, when it comes to employment law?
There are certainly retaliation actually is a pretty big one. And so if you're looking aside from just protections against discrimination, you know, race, gender, age, there's protections for being retaliated against, for complaining about discrimination, right? You make a complaint about discrimination, the employer says, I got a squeaky wheel here, it's not something I want to deal with, I'm going to get rid of them. You can't do that, right? So there's protections there. So retaliation is very prevalent. Sometimes even the retaliation claims are the strongest in the case, right? Even if under the law says, hey, you haven't been discriminated against to warrant, you know, money damages or other sort of relief, if you've been retaliated against in connection with complaints related to that, you can still have a case. So retaliation tends to be pretty prevalent. Gender discrimination, certainly up there. There's various statistics with our Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency that handles these sort of cases. That will show you specifically and more precisely what sorts of cases are happen more frequently than others.
Okay, I have a list of different types of discrimination, and just in case a listener isn't quite sure if they qualify or not, can you give us some examples? Let's start with gender. You know, whether you're even male, female, or gay, trans, like all that sort of thing. How can you be discriminated against?
Sure. So, yes, there are various different protected categories, right? Federally, national origin, age, you know, race, gender, pregnancy. So that's more federally. If you go locally, let's take New York, for example. New York has a much more robust list of protected characteristics. If you're a caregiver, for example, you know, military status, other sorts of protections as well. So important to keep in mind that there are various different types of laws, federal, state, and then even municipalities. So there could be various protections under them, for example, on the more local level, even if you don't have federal claims. So that's something to keep in mind. In connection with discrimination, it takes many different forms, right? Two prevalent situations are unlawful firings and hostile work environments, right? So the typical case for unlawful termination is where there is, you know, let's take for just gender discrimination, for example. A woman at work is being discriminated against because she's a woman. Maybe they're making inappropriate comments to her. She's not being advanced the same as her male colleagues who, you know, she has either the same or more experience than, more qualifications than them. And if she then, you know, maybe makes a complaint or, you know, something we see a lot of cases related to pregnancy as well, you know, becomes pregnant or even, you know, returning from pregnancy, then sort of setting the stage for a termination, right? It's very rare that there's a case where there's an email or a text message saying, hey, we need to fire Jane because, you know, she's a woman, or we need to fire Jane because she just got pregnant and she's not going to be devoted to the job anymore. It's much more based on circumstantial evidence. So if we take the pregnancy situation, for example, you know, employee announces or discloses that she's pregnant and then all of a sudden sees a change in the way she's treated, right? Maybe she was given high quality jobs and opportunities and those sort of start to disappear. She, you know, was a great performer, constantly receiving positive performance reviews, you know, in written form, orally as well. And then after she announces her pregnancy, all of a sudden she's the worst employee in the world, right? And she's being micromanaged, you know, not given those same opportunities. So those sorts of things, you know, maybe comments about, are you really going to be devoted to the company after you give birth? Like, how long are you going to be out for? It's going to be so difficult with you not here, right? All those sort of things taken together can start to show a discriminatory intent behind a decision, which most of the time takes the form of an unlawful firing.
I'm glad you mentioned the pregnancy, because I'm of an age where I think when I first got into the workforce, it was just common practice, like for wages, for example, that a man would be paid more than a woman for the same job. And that still goes on today. I hate to say that out loud, but it's true. You probably see that. The other thing, when I was like, I've got my list here, and under ageism, I've got something from your website that says the ADEA protects employees and job applicants who are 40 years of age and older from discrimination based on age. And I was going to mention that when I was young, again, a young woman could be either not hired or passed over because at some point in time, she is at baby making age, good chance that she might end up pregnant. So let's not even take a chance on her,
right?
Which is, yeah. And it sounds like that still happens today as well.
Yeah, certainly. I've had cases, and oftentimes the women in these cases tend to be the top performers in the various groups and industries that they're working for and in their companies. And there's just, unfortunately, you know, not everywhere, of course, but and not every instance, but there seems to be that sort of stigma still exists, even where the woman has shown that she's been a top performer in the past. So very frustrating. And, you know, of course, you know, we hope the discrimination sort of continues to decrease over time. And, you know, but unfortunately, it's a reality that will likely always be there. And so it's best to be sort of prepared and understand what your protections are and what you can do to address them.
Well, let me just slip a little comment in here that it was like about 50 years ago that I entered the workforce. So as a young attorney, you may have a whole career ahead of you if things keep on changing at the speed with which they've changed in the last 50 years. Okay, you all had also mentioned sexual, there's harassment and discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sexual harassment, I guess, is, I'm going to say relatively in air quotes, straightforward. You get your comments, touching, flirting. I was wondering, too, in terms of third party. So two people of one gender are at the water cooler making whatever comments about somebody of the opposite sex at their desk.
Mm-hmm.
Does that qualify as well? So that it's not direct, like I'm not making comments about you being, you know, a good-looking young man or something. It's to my coworker over there about you.
Right. So the lawyer answer is it depends, yeah. Right? And so sexual harassment, it becomes unlawful when it rises to the level of what's called a hostile work environment, right? So there's two different ways to prove hostile work environment. You can prove it based on the severity of some sort of conduct or action or behavior, or the pervasiveness of it. So you mentioned this sort of water cooler talk, maybe talking inappropriately about someone from the opposite sex. If that person hears it, perhaps that could be some sort of circumstantial evidence to support a hostile work environment claim, or if the comments make it back to that person, it could also be circumstantial evidence to support that kind of claim. Depending on what was said, though, would dictate whether that thing standing alone, that comment standing alone, would rise to the level of a hostile work environment. You know, if it was some sort of, you mentioned like touching, right? If it was a touching of an a private body part, if that happens one time, almost surely that's going to be a hostile work environment. Off-color comments or jokes, maybe, about women, if that happens one time, probably not going to be a hostile work environment. But let's say, the same person or group of people, or, it's regularly accepted in the workspace, and that continues to happen over an extended period of time, a couple times a week, every other day, over, several weeks, months, then that could rise to the level of a hostile work environment. So important to understand that sort of that distinction and when something might actually rise to a hostile work environment. But then to loop it back to retaliation, let's say there's this water cooler conversation and something inappropriate is said, either, someone overhears it or the person who it's said to is offended by it and makes a complaint. Like, hey, Jane at the water cooler today made this inappropriate comment about Jim and maybe some sexually charged comments. I feel sort of discriminated against because of the way that she was speaking. That now likely is what's considered a protected complaint or a protected activity. And so if the employer then terminates Jane for making that complaint, then that could be a retaliation claim. So there's a lot of nuance related to different circumstances that might happen in the workplace.
As we're talking, it's occurring to me too that there's a lot of sort of interrelatedness, because you mentioned jokes, mm-hmm. and, jokes about another race or religion. You write it off as, oh, it's just a joke, I'm just kidding.
Right.
But if it persists, then it is discrimination and or harassment.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, depending on the severity of it, right? If there's a joke about, I've been involved with a case where there was a situation where a black employee may have been given a copy of a newspaper with a picture of a cartoon monkey, right, for example. And given the historical context around those sort of discriminatory, derogatory associations, that even happening one time might rise to the level of a hostile work environment, right? The use of certain racially charged words or, typical discriminatory terms, even using one time might rise to the level of a hostile work environment. So it really depends on the facts of the situation and what might be unlawful harassment or hostile work environment.
Right. An incident comes to mind in Canada here where two fellas were on an airplane going north and made some comment about Eskimo. And they were both fired for it. And I'm maybe just admitting my own ignorance here, but I did not know that was a derisive term. I mean, I know we have Inuit people and different groups in the North, but, some terms, I guess, about East Asian and Black people, mm-hmm. they come readily to mind.
Sure.
But sometimes, hopefully, if it's an honest mistake, the person can be corrected, say mea culpa, and it moves on. It's just interesting how, times change and some things. And I guess, too, in terms of, I'm going to go with color here, skin color, is some, once again, I love my little air quotes because nobody can see them, jokes or phrases, they're okay between people of that group, but it's not okay for another, whether it's a skin color or race or whatever, to use those same terms. So being careful in the workplace is what I have found over the years to be just a good idea.
Yeah, of course. I mean, hopefully people are, their companies have trainings over these sorts of things. and you hope that, people will do their, do their best to avoid these sort of things. But unfortunately, it's a reality, and when it does become a problem, I try to help when I can.
Now, you said training. I'm glad you're using all these words because it's prompting more thoughts. Safety. Mm-hmm. If someone's on the job and they are given a task and they don't feel they've been trained appropriately and it does have what could be a dangerous angle to that task, is that something that you also deal with where the employer says, oh, everybody can figure that out, but you feel that, no, it has the potential to be dangerous?
Typically, no. The cases I typically handle are the discrimination, retaliation. You haven't been paid like overtime wages that you're entitled to under the law. Whistleblower cases, which I guess could involve some safety component as well. But there are those sort of protections for workplaces. Construction site comes to mind. Factories. With certain machinery. In terms of what sort of protections that they need, there's certain regulations related to different industries and machinery and what's required, how many fire exits you need and how they need to be, certain areas need to maybe be lit up to a certain degree, right? So there are various protections for the workplace and these more maybe physical type of jobs. And again, important to understand them because while laws and regulations exist, maybe your employer is not following them. And so if you do suffer some sort of injury, God forbid, there's recourse for you, maybe in at least for us, in terms of short-term disability type of situation. But if you get injured and now you suffer from a disability, and because of that disability, your employer fires you, then that's disability discrimination. So again, even coming out of those sort of situations, there's many different protections and many different avenues for recourse if for whatever reason your employer is violating the law.
You've done it again. Disability. This is great. It sounds like you've seen my notes. Disability seems to be one of those a little bit late to the table, but gaining momentum now in terms of access or accommodation. Do you deal with those?
Yeah, certainly. Disability cases. I have a disability case in New York City right now, actually. And they are prevalent, right? Because unfortunately, we all deal with some level of, health issues in our lives, hopefully, never too serious, but it happens, right? And so, or maybe you're born with some sort of situation that may require an accommodation. So it exists in the workplace, and you, at least, for us, you have an entitlement to, not to any accommodation that you request, right? You can't just say, hey, this is what I want, give it to me and I'm entitled to it. But the employer is required to work with you in an interactive process, right? So, if you get injured, you injure your, you break your arm and you need some sort of accommodation, maybe you can't type, so you need some software to help you, dictation software, right? That could be something to help you with a disability. Or if you, suffer a heart attack, for example, and you have a permanent heart condition and, need to be taken on, take on a lighter workload, that could be a sort of accommodation that might facilitate that sort of situation. But your employer is required to work with you to come up with something that would allow you to continue to do the job. Now, if it causes an undue burden, that's a term, legal term, or undue burden or hardship on the employer, then the employer can deny you that accommodation. But what constitutes undue burden? What constitutes hardship? Could they actually really still do the job? Do you really just not want to have to deal with this situation as the employer? Right, all those sort of questions come up in disability cases.
Well, I think too, more and more, the employers are one side of it, but just possible customers or clients. Mm-hmm. If they, for example, are in a wheelchair and they can't access your business, then, a lot of businesses are being called out on that too. I was actually just recently downtown, and I never go downtown anymore. And a street that I've, like in the old days, I've probably walked up hundreds of times, and I was like, Something's different. And I realized one of the businesses had actually built out into the sidewalk to create a ramp. And so part of it was stairs, part of it was ramp. But they'd had to, of course, extend because you can't have really steep ramps if people are self-propelled. And it was like, oh, okay, you know, obviously they're accommodating, whether it's an employee or a client, I don't know. But just interesting that they had made some pretty major changes to the entrance to their building.
Yeah, there are those. There are, outside of the employment laws, there are those protections here as well, right? A ramp accessible. Again, there's certain situations. If you have an older building and you're doing construction on it, you know, maybe now you were grant, like, quote unquote, grandfathered in to right. the situation and not have to take certain steps. But if you're remodeling in some sort of way, you may have to then, you know, update your facilities to meet whatever laws or regulations are there. So yeah, certainly protection so that everyone, you know, can have access and, you know, equal treatment.
Right. Now, we've been talking about employment law. And so if someone has a job, they're in the workplace or whatever looks like a workplace these days, a lot of people work from home. That's one thing and probably easier to document. But do you ever see cases where somebody thinks they weren't hired because of their gender, their skin color, or something like that? So they had all the qualifications, they were competitive with the other applicants, and or maybe they had more qualifications, I don't know, and didn't get the job. Do you ever deal with that sort of thing? Because I should think that's harder to prove.
Yeah, your instincts are good there, right? Those situations exist. I would say that they're rare in the employment law world for that exact reason, right? You know, how can you prove it? You need certain information to be able to say, these are the reasons why I think that there was discrimination here, right? So if, you know, you're applying, you're not going to necessarily know who the other applicants are. Maybe you do. I know maybe you're in the same waiting room with two or three other people, but, you know, that's just one day. Maybe there was 60 other people, right? And then even if you're aware of that, what are those person's qualifications, right? Maybe you get to talking with them, but do you know, like, the full background of their resume or anything, like, you know? So it's a lack of evidence sort of situation that makes those, or a lack of knowledge of evidence, right? Because that evidence may exist, right, behind the scenes, but your ability to know about it is often non-existent or very difficult.
Okay, I'm going to back up the bus now.
Yep.
If someone believes they're being discriminated against, how do they prepare to present to you, like to take it to you? Like what do they have to do?
Yeah, so this is probably the most important thing that we'll talk about today is being proactive rather than reactive, right? Oftentimes, almost every single time, the calls that I get are, you know, I've now been fired. I believe that this was unlawful, and these are the reasons why, right? And perfectly fine, you could have a case there, but there are times where someone comes to be in that situation and they maybe could have done, you know, A, B, C steps to protect themselves further, make sure they're maximizing their protections under the law. And in the employment context, it's very difficult, right? Because like I said earlier, there's typically not that smoking gun or like, hey, we need to fire you because you're a woman email, right? It's all different, maybe, you know, little things here and there that start to add up to that discriminatory intent. So if you get that sort of gut feeling that something's changed, something's different, you know, I gave my, you know, I gave notice that I'm pregnant, or I've now hit a certain age and I'm noticing, you know, a change and they're hiring only younger people and younger people are being advanced more than I am. As soon as you feel something like that's going on, it's probably the time to speak to an employment lawyer just so that you can understand your rights and what steps you should be taking. So that's probably the, you know, the first and most important thing you can do. But outside of that, you're going to want to make sure that you're keeping a record of what's happening, right? You know, I wasn't given this opportunity. I typically would. You know, I've had, you know, ABC client taken away from me, and those were like the best clients that I had, and they've now been given to someone else who's not pregnant, or, you know, who's much younger than me. So keeping track of that, keeping track of a change in how you're assessed in your performance, right? Again, going back to that example of I was, you know, top performer. Now, all of a sudden, the year that I hit a certain age, or, you know, I disclose my pregnancy, or I suffer a disability, now all of a sudden things are changing and I'm being micromanaged and I'm a terrible employee and everything I do is wrong, right? Like, those sort of things you're going to want to keep track of. And making a written complaint, right? Hey, I think I'm being discriminated against because of my age, because I'm pregnant, because of my race, you know, because of my gender. And here are the reasons why, you know, and sending that to someone who can do something about it, right? A supervisor, human resources, another authority in the company, right? If you just tell your best friend at work, who's the same level as you, you know, not a supervisor sort of level, then the idea is that what could the company have done, right? If that sort of person who's not kind of standing in the shoes of the company is the only person that knew about it. So taking those sort of steps to document things, make complaints. And again, because if you're making a complaint and they retaliate against you for making that complaint, that's unlawful. If you were to make a complaint such as, you know, I really don't like Jim, the way he's treating me, it's just not fair, you know, we don't get along. You don't mention anything about the fact that this has all happened since you announced your pregnancy, or, you know, since you attained a certain age. There's no connection then there to some sort of discrimination. So in that sort of way, that's why it's so important to work with an employment attorney, because I've done it plenty of times where I've helped people who are still employed draft these sort of complaints. The employer doesn't know that they've reached out to an attorney. I'm never going to disclose that, right? I have legal and ethical obligations not to do anything like that. Nor would I, even if that didn't exist, I wouldn't do that, right? So draft these sort of complaints, they submit them, and then if something happens, something bad happens, they now have these protections to take action. Whereas if they hadn't done something like that, they might not be able to, or it's not as strong. Their legal claims aren't as strong.
So if, say, over the course of, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 months, somebody is documenting the times they've, you know, been talked to derisively or the jokes, whatever mm-hmm. it is, they bring all this to you, they've itemized it. Perhaps they've already been to HR and HR goes like, it's just your imagination that they're really a nice person. And, you know, or, you know, you're going to be getting a promotion soon, so don't worry, but you won't see them again. So they brush it off some way or another. So this person comes to you. What do you do then? I'm just trying to get the process.
Yeah, no, of course. So attorneys do it differently. The way that we do it is we do a very detailed consultation process, right? Your call might be half an hour, might be longer than that. I've had calls go into an hour plus, depending on the facts of the specific situation. So an attorney should be doing a detailed consultation process, should be getting all the facts that they can from the employee. And then also requesting documents, whether that's before that initial call or after that initial call. What documents do you have? Do you have emails related to this? Do you have text messages? Do you have audio recordings? Do you have, you know, something else, you know, Slack messages or other, like, you know, Teams messages, other forms of instant messages, you know, outside of text messages? What else do you have in writing to support your claims, right? You can have claims without that sort of evidence, right? You don't need documents or, you know, anything written, for example, could be based all on verbal communications, but it's oftentimes those claims that have those written support is often stronger, particularly with those complaints of discrimination, those protected activities. So we'll look at all of that, assess the strength of the legal claims, and then also assess the value of them, right? If you, for example, if you're fired for an unlawful reason, and then the very next day you get a job that matches or exceeds your salary at the previous job, that's going to cut off, you know, their economic damages, right? Your salary that you would have recovered, bonus that you would have earned had you not been retaliated or, like, discriminated or retaliated against. So that will impact the value. There's still recovery for other things like emotional distress, but that changes the value, and it changes maybe strategy and negotiations on potentially resolving a claim.
Is it possible, or does it? What's the word? Is it effective if, say, you've got Let's just go with white. A white workplace, predominantly white workplace, you've got one person of another race or color, and they feel they're being discriminated against. And their coworker says, "Yeah, absolutely. Like, I can hear what that these people are saying," or something, and they corroborate. Is that helpful, or does it matter that you've got someone on your side, like with from the workplace?
It's extremely helpful.
Oh, okay.
And it can be rare because if, someone gets fired for what they believe is an unlawful reason, and now, they've contacted a lawyer and they're bringing the claim, and now, my best friend that I is still working there, right? So someone that their job is still connected to, that company, they're still, having to report to maybe the wrongdoer, the supervisor. And so there's maybe a very tangible, real fear that something might be done to you if you're helping this employee bring in the lawsuit, right? So it can often be a big deterrence for someone who is still at the company to come forward, as a witness. Maybe they're forced to participate in the lawsuit, right, through the various requirements, right? Like, hey, we want to hear your testimony. You have to come tell us what happened. But being proactive about it and willing to make a written statement is often much more rare, at least for people who are still employed, right? In those situations, though, if that person does make a written statement to support the person bringing the lawsuit, there are protections for doing that. But again, there's even if there are protections against retaliation, you could still be retaliated against, right? So you're losing your salary. For us, healthcare is oftentimes connected to your job, right? Your employer provides your healthcare. Huge consideration, right? Not just for yourself, if you have a family, those expenses, particularly here, are very, very high, right? So it's often those can often be big deterrences, but when they do happen, when you do get those statements from other witnesses, it is a very, very big support for the most part for those sorts of cases.
Okay, so I think the biggest surprise point of interest for me throughout our conversation is the number of times retaliation has come up. Is that common? I mean, I understand it, and I've certainly got it in my notes, but is it a huge piece of your work?
It is a huge piece, and it's a huge piece of the actual legal claims that we bring, and in the sort of actions that employees should be taking if they feel they're being subject to discrimination, sexual harassment, a hostile work environment, right? It should almost be understood that that's like when you're experiencing that, you need to make a written complaint, right? And you need to do it in a certain way that triggers the protections under the law, because without them, you're leaving yourself at a disadvantage, right? The idea of these employment lawsuits is to remedy what's happened to you, right? You've been, it took you time to find a new job after this unlawful firing. So the employer that fired you for a discriminatory or retaliatory reason should compensate you for that time, right? It took an emotional toll, right? Losing a job is a very, very difficult thing for most people to deal with, right? Everyone has bills. A lot of people live paycheck to paycheck. You have families, childcare, school. All these things are very real, and losing a job takes a huge emotional toll on people. So yes, it's incredibly important. They're incredibly important protections that are almost always a part of our lawsuits, and it's important for that to be also proactive, right? In making those complaints and working with an attorney, right? Every person's situation is different. And so while you may understand, hey, I probably need to make some sort of written complaint, you're going to want to reach out to an expert so that you can get specific legal advice tailored to your situation, right? And get that help from the employment attorney.
Now, when cases are taken to court, whatever happens, they are settled in favor of the employee. How many employees stay with the job? So say the supervisor, the boss, whatever is, you've got to take sensitivity training for whatever, and so they've had their knuckles wrapped, maybe the company gets fined for something or other. How many employees actually go back to their original position?
So you're talking about the employees who've suffered the unlawful conduct?
Yeah.
So almost never.
Okay.
Because most of the situations are terminations, right? That's sort of the typical lawsuit, either termination or hostile work environment. There could be discrimination while you're still employed there. That could be actionable. Like, let's say you're demoted, right? Your salary's cut. You're still employed there, but there is now a sort of tangible adverse action that could trigger legal claims that you could bring right away. So most of the time, it's a termination situation. And the laws do provide for reinstatement. It's something you can request from the courts, like, hey, you know, I was unlawfully treated. I'd like to be reinstated to my position. But it's something that is very rarely ever comes to fruition because, you know, the situation and then the lawsuit makes it untenable for the parties. And oftentimes, if you experience that at that employer, do you really want to go back there, right? So it happens, I'm sure. I can't think of an example from my experience. Most of the time, it's been just a separation, and a separation where after a person's able to get a result, a sort of, you know, weight lifted off them, they can kind of, you know, they feel like they've gotten justice to a certain degree and are able to move on with their lives and, you know, continue to pursue their career and sort of just forget about this terrible time that happened to them at their employer.
What is justice? So what's the potential for the employer?
So it's maybe not justice in the way that you might first think of it, right? Our legal system at least provides for the recovery of money damages. That's the main driver behind these civil lawsuits, and that goes the same for employment lawsuits. So the laws will provide for different recovery, right? I mentioned economics, right? Your salary, your wages, your hourly wage, you know, what you would have earned had you not been unlawfully fired, the emotional distress that you experienced. There could be money damages to punish the employer. Like, what you did was so bad, you know, we need to throw this extra money at you so that you don't engage in this behavior again. And we're sending a signal to other companies, whether in the industry or just in general, like, do not do this. Take action to make sure this stuff doesn't happen, because this is what could happen to you. So, you know, there's other sorts of damages, but that's really what it's related to. Could you? There are situations where, you know, settlements or even, you know, verdicts could lead to a change in company policy. Maybe someone has to get a certain training. Maybe a specific wrongdoer loses his or her job because of the unlawful conduct they engaged in. Those sort of situations are rare. It's rare to exact that sort of organizational change. But the money does some of that as well. You know, if the employer has to, you know, loses a trial and has to pay, you know, based on what the verdict is, or, you know, is forced to settle based on the strength of the claims and, you know, the risk of what could happen at trial, that settlement could in itself, outside of, you know, specific changes in a handbook or trainings or stuff like that, that settlement itself could drive that sort of change, whether or not it's required in the settlement.
As you were explaining that, I was thinking that if it was a larger company and it's sort of a middle manager that has been inflicting whatever discrimination on an employee, when all that comes to light and it goes to court and whatever else happens, it could be upper management that says, like, what the, like, this should not be going on in my company. And that's when policies can be implemented or training or something. You know, if you want to be a manager at this middle management level, you need to, like, everybody, just make it across the board. Everybody's got to have this sort of education or training or whatever to right. Just to make sure that doesn't happen.
Yeah. And there could be those sort of things reacting to what happens. And like I mentioned before, it would be great if there was a world without discrimination. It's not realistic. So, you know, from the employer side, doing what you can to limit those situations and then taking appropriate action to address them. Again, that's not, you would hope that every company follows that sort of procedure, but it's not always the main motivation of a company. So, you know, there are those protections there, and make sure that you know about them and what to do with them.
I keep on throwing scenarios at you, but my imagination was going rampant when I was doing my notes. It's some of those harassments might not be from your supervisor, could be from the person at the next desk. So
Sure.
completely equal level employee. Do you still have those same rights and protections in terms of, I take it you would take it to your supervisor or to HR or something first.
Yes, you do. You still have protections from a hostile work environment, even if it's someone at your level, below your level, any employee at the firm, or even if it's a third party, right? If for whatever reason your company regularly engages with third parties and you're experiencing a harassment, whether it's sexual harassment or harassment, other unlawful harassment based on race or other protected characteristic, yeah, that could still very much be actionable under where it's a situation where there's a supervisor. Maybe those cases are a little stronger because you're dealing with someone who's essentially stepping in the shoes of the employer. Where if it's a colleague who's at the same level or a lesser level, you have to make sure you go through the channels to report it, right? Even if it's with the supervisor, you need to go through the channels to support it. But especially when it's someone who's equal or lesser of a level, because again, the employer needs to know about it. So you go through and again, working with an employment attorney to do that, like, hey, look, this is what your company's handbook says. You need to do, XYZ steps. I'll help you along the way. Maybe there's some sort of investigation. I can prepare you for that. So making sure that you follow those steps so that they can't say, oh, well, we never heard about it. Or, you were supposed to make a complaint to HR and you never did, right? A written complaint. So that's very important. But yes, certainly if you're experiencing that from someone who's not a supervisor, it can still be actionable.
Okay, well, one last scenario.
Yeah, sure.
You're not the victim, but you're watching something take place with a coworker who's too scared to speak up. What do you do? What can you do as just the observer who's getting really ticked off with what's going on to this other person in the office?
Yeah, depending on your title and where you stand in the company, first you may have an obligation to do it, right? If you're in some sort of supervisory role, manager role, higher level role, you may have an obligation to report that sort of conduct. But even if you're not, you can still go through the various channels to complain about it. It doesn't have to be the person experiencing discrimination to make a complaint. Right. If another person is making that complaint on their behalf, then that person who's making the complaint still has those protections from, again, retaliation. Hey, I think, Jim is being discriminated against because of his age. All these different employees are making comments about, when are you going to retire? You can't keep up anymore. You're getting slow. We need new energy here. I really think that he's being discriminated against based on his age. Here are the examples. That's likely protected. So if the employer's like, why are you speaking up about this person? Like, we don't need this here. Like, we're just trying to make as much money as possible. And then the likely scenario is, all right, we're firing you. That person would have likely have claims under the employment laws for again retaliation. So those protections exist even for people who are complaining on behalf of others.
I'm just thinking that it's two people looking for a new job.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, we won't go there. What's the best way for a person to find out just what their rights are? Is there youremploymentrights.org somewhere?
Yeah, I mean, you name it, you can go sort of, you can Google, the AI platform, ChatGPT will spit out stuff for you. But what you really should be doing is speaking to an employment lawyer, right? It when and you can find we don't charge for our consultations, and an employment lawyer shouldn't be on our side, who's representing employees, shouldn't be charging for those sort of calls. They should be free. They should be detailed. You should walk away with an understanding of the employee's assessment of the strength of your claims, the value of them, so that you can make a choice. You can make a choice about what you want to do, whether it's worth it for you to take certain legal action, whether you ultimately decide not to, but at least you've done the legwork to understand where you stand. And even if it is in like a termination situation, understanding what you can do to protect yourself in the workplace, right? Again, you can look up and, you know, find certain literature about the laws, but an attorney's gonna be able to explain to you, this is how it applies to your situation. These are the sort of things that you can do. And then hopefully guide you, right? Whether it's making those, you know, helping you draft those protected emails or, you know, other written complaints to your employer to make sure you have those protections that could be the basis of a retaliation claim. That's the most important thing, because you can do that. It's private. It's confidential. Your employer's never going to know about it. And even if you decide to do nothing, at least you have an understanding of where you stand. So that would be the most important thing. Again, those should be free. And people on my side of the litigation typically represent employees on a contingency fee basis, right? Meaning that I don't get anything unless we're able to get a result for you. So I'll put up the cost for your case, the filing fees, you know, deposition transcript fees, expert fees, and those can be recovered as part of the case, but they're fronted by the law firm. And you don't have to pay anything. You're not getting a monthly bill like, you know, Taylor worked 100 hours on your case this month and you owe this much money. The average person can't afford something like that. So that's why these cases are typically handled on a contingency fee. So my firm will get a percentage of whatever recovery we're able to get for you.
I want to just do a show and go on the road with you, because every time I ask a question, you follow it up with exactly what my next question would have been. So that's great. Thank you.
We're working well together.
Yeah, exactly. Is there anything we haven't talked about in this whole big murky world that you would like employees, and especially older employees? This is the Boomer Woman's podcast. Some of our listeners are 50 plus.
Yeah.
And, is there anything we haven't talked about that?
Yeah, just again, that there shouldn't be a sort of fear or stigma about contacting a lawyer to learn about your rights. You know, again, it's a no risk situation. You can ultimately decide to do nothing, but why not here? You know, yeah, you know, I don't think you have legal claims here based on what you told me, or actually, I think you really have strong legal claims here, and these are your options to do something about it. So, you know, and especially someone who's maybe been in the workforce for a while, they've experienced work culture shifting over the years, and maybe there's been new protections implemented, new laws that apply to the workplace situation. So where there maybe was a sort of tolerance or acceptance of the way certain things used to be, you know, that's maybe changed a little bit, and you can feel a little more emboldened about coming forward and protecting yourself, right? Because it can be very difficult for an older person to find a new job, right? To start at a new company, and being fired because you're older, even though you can still do the job, even though you're still performing great, just because there's some preconceived notion that if you hit a certain age, you're no longer valuable to us, and we want the younger people. You know, that's not fair. So just take that first step, learn about your situation, and at the very least, you walk away with the knowledge you need to make a decision for yourself.
That's good. I talked to somebody who coaches older people who they're ready to leave the workplace, but they're not ready to sit in their rocking chair.
Right.
And she said older employees, instead of being given challenges in the workplace, they're now being given projects. Like,
right.
just keep them busy until they decide to retire, you know.
Right.
So yeah, it's very frustrating, because yeah, a generation or two ago, 60, 65, certainly 70 was pretty old for most people.
Yeah.
But nowadays, shapers, you know, people are working through their 70s. Yeah, oh, yeah. Okay, we won't go there. Oh, dear. Where do we find you on the World Wide Web?
Yeah, so our website is www.crabillelawfirm.com. Crabill is C-R-A-B-I-L-L. That's the best place to you know, if you're in the States, if you're in Florida, New York, or, you know, any other place, That's a place. That's where you can go to schedule a consultation. We have a spot where you can set up a Zoom call that would be very similar to this, where we would assess your situation and see how we might be able to help. Our phone number is 727-335-1030. If you'd rather call in and set up the call or the meeting that way, those are the best ways to contact us. You can also shoot an email directly to me, T Crable, again, Crabill, at crablelawfirm.com. And if that's easier for you, then we can set up the consultation that way.
Okay, so we got somebody sitting in California who says, "Oh my God, like I want to know more." Do you have colleagues like around the US, or would you? I just it sounds like you're busy enough that you don't need to be taking out those temporary licenses in other states, especially clear across the country. How do you handle consultations with out of state people usually?
It depends. I mean, I do. I have, I'm not admitted to practice in New Jersey, but I have a case in New Jersey at the moment. I'm actually exploring in another state where I'm not admitted as well. So we do take on those cases. But yes, the employment law network is, I guess, a fairly small world, and likely that we could, if we don't know somebody directly, steer you in the right direction of where to go and at least what to look out for, right? Because there's no reason for somebody to know what to expect on a consultation call, how long it should be, what sort of details should be going into it. So, yeah, we could certainly help direct you to someplace, but do your due diligence, speak to multiple places, and you'll hopefully get a good gut feeling about someone who's able to help you out.
You speak so well. Thank you for that. This is doing just great. Okay, your website link is in the show notes, and actually everything that you just talked about, phone number, email, all that will be in the show notes, and everything's also on your page at our website.
Great.
Listeners, I really hope that none of you needed this conversation, this information today. But if you are in a position of discrimination, find support and bring the person to task. If they are capable of it with you, they are capable of it with others. I'd appreciate hearing your thoughts, so talk to us. Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. And as I do occasionally say, if you're reluctant to speak out, please use a pseudonym, like if you just need to give air but you don't want your name attached to it. None of your personal information shows at the website, so do it there, not at a podcast platform. Maybe there was a question I didn't ask Taylor. Ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. As always, share this episode. Someone you know might need this information and some support. Taylor's information might be the catalyst for action. If you found this episode helpful, please click the follow button on your podcast player. That's even more helpful to our growth than stars and reviews. I'm also registered at Substack. Following there is free, and you'll receive an email every time a new episode is released. Taylor Crable, thank you for being my guest today and sharing so much important information about workplace harassment, discrimination, so much. I really wish you didn't have a booming practice, but I'm glad you're there for those folk who do need you.
Thank you so much, Agnes. Happy to join you today.
Have a great rest of week.
You too.